Welcome, you're listening to the Crass Files podcast. It's Sunday the 17th of April 2016. You can get this podcast over at iTunes and also from our website crassfiles.com. Lots of stuff going up there. We're also over at iTunes and under the Crass Files and Twitter as well. Another website is Open Source Truth. Go and check that out as well. Thanks for listening, as always. Okay, we are ready to rumble. We're all plugged in. My guest today is Joseph Plummer, all the way from the United States. Joseph, good to have you on the Crass Files podcast down under.
Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. You've done a pretty momentous job here. Just found out about your work recently, and it's really incredible. You've written a book called Tragedy and Hope 101. So the great Carl Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, which is a momentous book indeed. You've put out a more digestible book for all of us to go through, much easier. And I was just telling you before we started that I think Garth, my dad, and a couple of friends have read the original Tragedy and Hope and said it was just amazing. You ought to read it, and I really want to one day. But my time frames and just the way I am at the moment, it's very hard. So your book is really incredible for people like myself. It's a big book, as we know, the original book. From just going through your notes and your book, I think it's about 1,300 pages, the original book. So that'd be about 600,000 words, I think I noted down.
Yes.
The book weighs about 5 pounds. It's a massive, massive, massive book. And it's a dry read, my father said, you know, as it says, it's a lot about economics and political sort of stuff and diplomatic history. But he goes into, from what I've heard, incredible detail. So about this, you know, we always talk about that here, you know, what's going on in this life? Who's behind the mask? You know, who's behind the mask, behind the mirror, behind time? You know, what's going on? Who are these global leaders, you know, the bankers, and who's running the show here? So just looking at your book, G. Edward Griffin put a couple of notes there at the start, which was awesome. He, of course, wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island. And he says here at the start of your book, I can say without reservations that you are about to learn some of the oldest held secrets. Joe has done an outstanding job here. That's what he says, weeding through Quigley's book. He has captured the essence of what Quigley referred to as the network. And media, he's important information accessible to average person like myself, who just simply don't have the time to pick up and read a 1,300-page history book. so that was really great, and I've just started your book, and it's fantastic. I noted immediately that you really get into the meat and bones, and it captured me straight away, and I'm just flicking the pages going through. So that was fantastic. I'm really enjoying this book. For where I am at the moment in it. And as I said, for all our listeners out there who may have read Tragedy and Hope or the original or may not even know what it is, your book is a really amazing introduction to this monumental work that was done. So why don't we start off here and get to know you a little bit a bit about your work, who you are, where you're from, all of that, and why you decided to do this. Tell us a little bit about the original book and why it's so important for today, because we're really living this, aren't we? So, and it must have, I don't know how easy it was for you to do something like this, because I can't even imagine where to start, to take a book like that. My goodness.
I'll tell you that easy is not a word that describes it.
I don't know how you did it.
Okay. But first of all, yes, I want to thank you for all the kind words, and obviously it's great that Ed Griffin was interested in writing the introduction for me. I was very, very grateful for that. As far as the book is concerned, Tragedy and Hope, the original 600,000-word, 5-pound, 1,300-page behemoth, it just is not practical to think that most people are going to be able to go through that. They're just not. It's not only is it 1,300 pages, but it's 1,300 pages of small print, which matters. Okay, so the publisher is trying to save money by condensing it down, by reducing the size of the print. Really, what you've got there, if it was at the same print size as my book, you'd have about a 2,000-page book. So it is enormous, and the average reader probably isn't going to be able to suffer that, or you can't expect it. It's not that they can't, it's just, if you want to reach a wide audience with the information that's contained in that book, it's very difficult because the masses aren't going to be able to tolerate sitting for the amount of time necessary to get through it.
And yours is 200, isn't it? Your Tragedy and Hope 101 is about 200 pages.
Exactly. So yeah. This is something that just makes it, it takes basically that what's so important about Carol Quigley's work is A, his credentials. There's the obligatory introduction to who is Carol Quigley. Well, Carol Quigley was one of the most prominent historians of the 20th century. He earned his PhD at Harvard. He went on to teach at Harvard. He taught at Princeton. He taught at the prestigious School of Foreign Services at Georgetown University for decades. And he specialized really in studying the nature of government and the evolution of civilizations and how things work. So what's really important about his work in Tragedy and Hope is it reveals the secrets of the system and how it operates. It helps people understand something that the system does not want them to understand. And the problem with it, of course, being that in its current form, in that original form, it's inaccessible. So that was the whole purpose, really, of writing Tragedy and Hope 101, as you might imagine. It's an introduction to this work, and it's heavily footnoted. So anybody who wants to go through Tragedy and Hope 101, like let's say they come across something that seems really bold, like a really bold statement coming from such a prominent, well-credentialed historian. It seems like, wow, did he really say that? Well, there's a footnote there for it, and you can go directly to it in Tragedy and Hope, or an easier way really to do it for people who don't want to pay the $40 for the full book. Tragedy and Hope, the actual book, is available online in a PDF form. So if you ever want to, reference a quote that's in my book, just take a few words from the passage that I'm quoting, and then search the Tragedy and Hope PDF, and that'll take you directly to the passage in Quigley's book, and you'll be able to make sure that it's in context, and you can do additional research from that point.
I'm going to put that up today as well, the original PDF with this link, and links to get your book as well,
Sure. So anyway, really, again, the purpose, the reason I wrote it, is because the information is so incredibly important. It's so incredibly important for people to realize how the world actually operates, that they have been intentionally deceived. And this is verifiable. It can be proven, and it is proven by this very well-respected historian who not only specialized in studying the true nature of secretive coercive power, but he was actually close to its instruments, and in many ways he was in agreement with them. So he was actually allowed inside this network that he exposes, and he was able to look at their secret papers, and he shows people how they essentially gained control and how this small group, this secret society, his word, can control nations and major world events without anybody even knowing they existed. And what an incredible fact of history that is, where he says, you know, this is one of the most important facts of American and world history in the 20th century, and yet nobody knows anything about it. So, you know, coming from a man of his with his credentials, that's a pretty powerful statement.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. So tell us a little bit about this man, maybe if you will, and how what happened, because I was reading in your book that there was a lot of controversy as well with his book, you know, with getting it out there, and they tried to stop him as
yes.
well, and which
yeah.
is which is amazing, because we're getting so much of that now, just even with films now, mass censorship and stuff, but he seemed to be in the know and in with the elites and in with the groups, but I guess they, from what I gather reading yours, is that they didn't even expect him to come out with such a with such a heavy book exposing so much, and then tried to stop it. So the man would have gone through a lot to get his book out there for the masses, but I guess going back to what you said before, it's sort of sad having such a momentous book locked up in a package that no one can really read, you know,
right.
and there's so much valuable knowledge in there. And I can imagine it must have been hard for him to do something like that and then face such opposition to his book getting out there and such censorship as well.
Yeah, some have speculated that, you know, the first book that he did, the first that he released, was Tragedy and Hope. And as stated, it's 95% general economic, political, and diplomatic history. 5% really, really heavy information, okay? So some have speculated that he intentionally buried the really heavy stuff in between all of the other stuff, and that's how it initially got past the editors. But of course, once people discovered the heavy stuff and started talking about it and highlighting it, well, that caused some trouble, and the powers that be made their displeasure known by suppressing his work. And there's another element to the story, which is that Quigley really, I think initially, was, you know, I obviously disagree with him on a lot of things, but generally speaking, I think he, at the beginning, still believed in the good intentions of these people. He just kind of disagreed with some of the ways in which they pursued their objectives. But toward the end, I believe he started to realize that, you know, so like, let's just say, hey, I'm your friend and I like what you're trying to do, but I'm going to try to influence you to do it a little bit differently. Like, let's stop acting in secrecy. Let's stop using so much deception. We need to have more accountability so that our mistakes aren't buried and we don't continue to make the same mistakes over and over again. You know, you can kind of put yourself in that type of mindset where you'd be talking to a friend or a group of people who you kind of identify with, but you're just not quite on the same page with. Mm. Toward the end, I think he realized, okay, I misinterpreted what these people are, and I misinterpreted what they're after. And, you know, I can't prove that. I believe, even on Wikipedia, which is kind of the anti-conspiracy site, you know, anything that could be potentially conspiratorial has to be, you know, they take things down that aren't conspiratorial, claiming that it is. So even on Wikipedia, last I checked, there was a, which I haven't verified this, but there was a reference to somebody who was close to Quigley contacting Gary Allen, and Gary Allen was who wrote None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which was one of the first books to really gain traction and talk about what Quigley exposed in Tragedy and Hope, where one of Quigley's associates had contacted Gary Allen and said that toward the end of his life, Quigley realized that it was a nefarious operation, and that he didn't believe so much in their good intentions anymore. And so, you know, there's another book, which I also work into Tragedy and Hope 101, that Quigley wrote, that wasn't published until after he died, which was called The Anglo-American Establishment. Now, that book specifically is 100% about the secret society. And again, I wish I could confirm it, and there might be some way to do it, but the issue with Anglo-American Establishment being published posthumously, I've read that is how he wanted it, because he knew how devastating it was. And in that, he's definitely a little bit more critical. He comes right out and says, you know, what these people achieved was terrifying, and no nation that values its freedom would allow any group to gain this much power, because it's just dangerous, no matter who controls it. And I agree with that. That's the problem with unaccountable centralized power. It's dangerous. It doesn't matter who controls it. It's just too much.
They're just without morals, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They just don't care. Indifferent.
Go ahead.
No, they're just, I don't know. It's like another whole species. And I got reading that in your book near the beginning, you know, that the common man like us, you know, we strive to do better and we pay our taxes and, you know, we want to be good people and do the right thing for our fellow man. But these people are almost psychopathic in their nature, just so sterile and cold. You know, they just don't think like us. And I always think, well, what the hell's going on here, you know? It's just amazing, you know, to see this taking place, not just then, but still going on now so strongly. You know,
it is a characteristic. It's a characteristic of their mentality. So we already know that psychopaths are real and that psychopaths are capable of doing things that most normal people can't. So that's what makes them psychopaths, that they function a certain way. And unfortunately, these people don't believe in a moral dimension. They hide behind morality because they fully understand our psychology. They understand our psychology and where we're coming from, and they understand how to manipulate that. But for them, the only measure of right and wrong is whether or not what they do works or it fails. And it's that simple. It's unfortunately true, but you can, you know, on occasion when they're communicating with one another, they will admit that. They will say it. So you can always reference their own texts and read it for yourself.
Yeah. It seems that they also have a sick need to tell us what they're going to do or what they are doing to us. It depends how deep down the rabbit hole you want to go, but, you know, there's certain Illuminati symbolism and hand gestures and things they do right on camera, you know, as well, and seems to go way back in history. But as it says on your front of your book, The Illusion of Justice, Freedom and Democracy, it astounds me, you know, in Australia it's so bad because we have pretty much a two-part political system, which David Icke greatly calls opposames. You know, we have Liberal and Labour. And it's just a vicious circle. And every 3 years, people vote Liberal government back in, and then they get sick of them, and then they go and vote Labour government back in, and then they get sick of them, and it just goes on and on and on and on, and there's just no end to it. And the masses just don't seem to be waking up. And I know it's similar in the United States and many countries. This is in the UK and European countries. There's just, you know, any other independent parties are squashed. And it amazes me that it's still going on in 2016, because it's like a wrestling match. You know, in Australia, they put on this show for the mob, but behind closed doors, they're all patting each other on the back and they're all buddies. But, you know, if you go back decades, centuries, you know, if you look just the last 10 years, 20 years in Australia, you can see that they've implemented everything that they wanted to do. I mean, Australia has turned into a real kind of draconian almost police state. It's a nanny state here. And so many things that each government does are so unpopular, but they keep voting them back in. And I'm starting to get this from your book as well, which immediately jumped out at me. You know, I just don't understand. It is an illusion. People do think they live in a just world. They think they live in a democratic society, and it's 2016 and they're still thinking like that. It's an amazing thing. And I guess these, networks of vicious individuals who are running the show, I guess they don't even really have to police us anymore because we're doing it for them, aren't we, in many ways.
I'll tell you, there's a couple things. First of all, what you're mentioning, there's a great quote from Quigley regarding that, where as a member of the group of insiders, not part of the actual secret society, but as a person who's close to it and its instruments, his own words, he has that quote where he says, of course the two parties are nearly identical. That's how it needs to be. The two parties need to be nearly identical so that the angry electorate can throw the rascals out at any election and it doesn't lead to any profound shift in policy that is determined by the experts. So this is the experts being the people who are actually determining policy, these people behind the scenes who control everything but lead everybody else to believe that they have some kind of hand in it. So right there he's exposing this illusion, and he goes on to say that it's clear that the experts will completely replace the Democratic voter in control of the political system in the 20th century. So of course we're far out of the 20th century at this point. We're now well into the 21st century. And, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me was this apparent conflict that he had. He was conflicted on this. He starts with one breath saying, of course it needs to be this way. Then he says the thing about the experts are going to replace the Democratic voter. And then he kind of backs off a little bit and says, well, you know, hopefully the average person will have some say in his political destiny because it would be kind of unfortunate if they didn't. But generally speaking, they're going to be controlled from birth to death, and their choices are going to be controlled within very narrow margins. So you can see he's kind of backing away there, and then by the time you get to the Anglo-American establishment, he's coming right out and saying what I had stated earlier about this is they have too much power, and it's just terrifying, and you can't trust this to any group. So I will say that, yes, this has worked very well for them for a long time, but I think that, especially with the internet, I think awareness is growing, and I think people are starting to figure it out. I really, truly believe that. Mm. They're becoming more and more disillusioned and more aware of the fact that, wow, this really is nothing but a carefully managed con game. It's the same thing over and over and over again, and they're starting to see through that illusion. And that's the key. The key to their power, they derive their power from the ignorance and cooperation of the electorate. So, you know, if we're able to erode that one thing that they themselves felt that they needed, which was to control through secrecy, then what happens to their power? Clearly, when people realize that, wow, you know, yeah, I see these clowns that you're parading around, but who chose the clowns that I'm supposed to choose from? You know, that's a question nobody asks themselves. Once people start asking those questions, like, who decided these are the best candidates? I didn't have any say in it. You know, it's this backing away from the show and the whole illusion of it all, and starting to realize that the whole system is controlled, and then you can prove it's controlled, and that by voting for these people that are put before you, you're never going to change anything, because the people who control the system are the ones who's using their instruments, their media, for instance, to parade them around in front of you so you feel like you have a choice. But any horse that you choose is a horse that they chose for you. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know, I'm looking at the US elections at the moment with Trump being so popular. Sure. and all that, but it just all seems like a circus act, like, yeah, a circus show, you know?
Sure.
You know, I don't know if Trump will be better for America, I guess the Americans know that, but you look at it all, it just seems like a big carnival sideshow, doesn't it, just rolling on. It's amazing when so much is going on behind the scenes that the general public aren't seeing it all, you know?
I think there's a good thing about Trump and Sanders, which is it's showing people. I think Trump probably I'm not backing Trump, but I think he definitely has his own money. So he didn't need the network to give him media coverage and create momentum for him and say good things about him. He is his own independent self.
Yep.
Okay. And Bernie Sanders, I think, probably is well-intentioned, although he could be used by the network because he wants to spend, and anything that creates debt serves their interests. Clearly, they would rather have the 100% locked-in establishment candidate of Hillary Clinton. So what you have is you have two people out of the two choices that you're given, Republican or Democrat. Like you said, the independent parties are irrelevant. They're not even given any time or any say by the network. You have these two people, and what everybody is kind of finally waking up to is how the establishment is fighting these two independent people. So that's one valuable thing that's coming out of this contest, is the people who really truly believe that Bernie Sanders is the right person is seeing how the Democratic establishment is going to do everything they can do to lie, cheat, and steal so that Sanders doesn't get it. And the same thing is true on the other side, with the Republican establishment doing everything it can to prevent Trump from winning, up to and including making, if it means Hillary Clinton has to win, they would rather have Hillary win, because why? Nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
The establishment's going to stay exactly the same way as it is now. So in that sense, I think the what's going on right now is valuable.
Well, they must hate exposure in any way. You know, so they keep way out of it.
Yeah, they're uncloaking now. You know, they have to come out and you know, play their games, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just looking at your site and Quigley talking about unsettling, this power that operates behind the scenes in secrecy. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all these so-called, as we just talked about, democratic elections. These secret societies and powerful networks, I mean, you know, doing what we're doing and talking to different guests and looking into conspiracy theories and everything, you know, whether you go to 9/11, back to the Kennedy assassination, all this stuff, you hear a lot of different things about who these people may be. We look at, you know, World War II, how the Federal Reserve was set up. You look at these mega wealthy banks, Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, you know, have a lot of power. You hear about the Rothschilds, Rockefellers. You hear about the City of London, the Vatican, and the money they have, and all this. What's your idea on these networks? What did Quigley say? Because I haven't, as I said, I haven't read his book, and I'm going through yours, but what did he get into? Are these bloodline-related families, as we hear? What's your thoughts on the Zionist sort of Jewish control of the world and America? What do you think about all this? And you know, because the Zionist sort of Jewish element, it is pretty crazy when you look. They do have a lot of power with AIPAC and the banking system and media and pornography and our entertainment and everything. To sit here all day and just blame them, completely blame them, you know, there's a lot of other people involved here. Have you got a scope of what we're dealing with these people? We hear about Freemasonry. We hear about even black magic and Satanism and these sort of rituals you see them do at Bohemian Grove. But, you know, for me, I've got to sort of take a bit and piece at a time and sort of do my own research, come up with my own ideas. At the end of the day, I think, God, I know so little about the, you know, you see the Queen of England, the royals, you know, as I said, the Pope. These people have power, but you've got these hidden networks who seem to have extreme amounts of money that control everything. And to think that they use the world's militaries and NATO to protect the corporations as well, which is a very important subject, which protects them as well. And, you know, it's amazing to look at this, but what are we looking at here? What sort of kind of people? Are we looking at bloodline-related families that go back in history behind the curtains here, really deeply?
Well, let's put it this way. I try to stick mainly to what Quigley talks about. Obviously, Tragedy and Hope 101 is about tragedy and hope. So Quigley doesn't get a lot into a lot of that stuff. But yes, absolutely, he talks about the power of the Rockefellers. He talks about the power of the Rothschilds. He, you know, he mentions the Balfour Declaration and says the Balfour Declaration should have been called the Milner Declaration because Milner was the one who wrote it. Of course, nobody knows that. So there are bits and pieces of all of that in it. Now, I imagine it's probably easy to imagine. It's difficult to try to condense so much information into some kind of coherent, readable narrative. So for me, I have to, in my own mind, condense all this into something that's usable for me. And what's really usable to me is that it's not so much about the individuals. Yes, you want to look at the Rockefellers. You want to look at the Henry Kissingers of the world, or you know, the Rothschilds, or any of these people, and see how much power they have. It's true that the names to a certain point are important, But more important than the names, in my view, are the instruments that these people have created, because you could go kill all these people. But as long as the Federal Reserve System, so let's say somebody says, okay, the Federal Reserve System is totally controlled by Zionists. That's fine. Whether it's true or not, it isn't going to be any better if it's totally controlled by somebody else. It's too much power to trust to anybody. It's kind of like going back to that statement of Quigley. It's one of those things where giving somebody a money machine is not a group of people giving them this unaccountable, centralized amount of control is not a good idea. So you have the governments, which have become instruments of secret power. You have the income tax and the Federal Reserve System, which are both instruments of this secret power. You have the CFR and the CIA and all of these other, well, the CFR being the think tank, but then the CIA, the NSA, and all these other alphabet soup agencies. You have the military. You have monopolization of the media, monopolization of money, monopolization of medicine, manufacturing, education, energy, all of these things that they control. That is really all of these things that they've turned into their instruments. For me, that is what we have to do to defeat them. We have to work on decentralizing all of these things that they've monopolized. So, for instance, in media, that's what you're doing. You're part of the solution in the sense that you are providing an alternative source of information to the media that they had monopolized for so long. And look at the impact. Look at the impact of what you're doing, the impact of Alex Jones, the impact of Corbett Report, the impact of Richard Grove, and all of these other people who are doing this work. It's enormous. It's huge because it's basically a parallel competing system. I think sometimes people get really, what's the word? I don't want to say apathetic, but maybe they're just not as enthusiastic as they should be about the very significant power that we possess. They'll say, okay, well, I know what's going on now, so what? Nobody cares. It's not true, and it really is the most important thing that you can do. Raising awareness is the most important thing you can do, because for every 1 million people we wake up, let's say there's 1 million of them, a very, very tiny percentage of them are going to go, they're going to become obsessed. And they're going to start creating solutions. Now, the vast majority, let's say 990,000 of them, are going to have varying degrees at which they participate. Some aren't going to participate at all, but at the very least, they're not going to be dupes anymore. So they're going to know the system is BS, and they're not going to be duped by it anymore. So that in and of itself is valuable. But you have this small group of people who are going to create alternatives in money, alternatives in media, alternatives in medicine, alternatives in energy, alternatives in education. And that larger group of people are going to be the early adopters. And they're going to be the ones who, when that solution is presented, are going to be drawn to it. And so if I had a message for anybody, it's like, do not underestimate for 1 second the power of just educating yourself and educating other people. There are going to be people who don't want to hear it. That's fine. They don't matter. Present the information. Don't beat them over the head with it. There is enough of a segment of the population who is willing to do research and look at this stuff. Start there. Start there. Create the base. And begin this process. As far as I'm concerned, that's how all change occurs. It can't happen any other way. And with regard to this particular system that we're living under, these people absolutely, again, they derive their power from the ignorance and the cooperation of the masses. So to the extent that we can undermine that, and to the extent out of however many million we wake up, we inspire people to start creating these parallel competing systems in all of these areas that they've monopolized. We're going to start making progress towards eroding the foundation. And I'll just throw this in there for the eternal pessimist. Let's say, for instance, that they say, oh, okay, well, yeah, that all sounds good, but I'm not sure it's worth it or whatever. That's fine. That's their prerogative. the question I'd ask him is, okay, so does that mean you're going to join them? Because you have a choice. You can join them. You can say, okay, it's in my best interest to join this system. But I'm not doing that. So I don't care. Even if you were to say, okay, it's going to take 100 years and I'm never going to see her, I don't care. Because for me, I can't sit back and live beneath people who are morally inferior to me and damn near everybody else on the planet. I mean, they literally are the most dishonest, brutal, ruthless people in the world. Why would anybody not want to resist that?
That's right.
You know?
It just seems like the Stockholm Syndrome. We always mention that, you know? It's amazing. I always think, you know, that it's a mental thing as well. And I feel like that's where they're breaking us down. You know, and I know that, you know, your visual sort of projection, you know, what you put forward, your thoughts, the way you think, the way you feel, the way you put that out to not just yourself and your family and your friends around you, that shapes and changes your reality.
Yes.
In this life, if you're waking up every day in a negative state, that's what you're going to get. And then as that, you get more of that, you get more negative because you think the world's against you, but you're actually creating it. And I think the world's in a serious state because we've created that in a way. And as you said before, they know whatever this power system that we're talking about, this network, they seem to know the human being very, very well. They know us on such a deep level, on a spiritual level as well. They seem to know how we think, how we operate. And it's amazing in a media sense how they can manipulate us on such a deep level but be so detached from that. You know, they can make us think that they're on our side. You know, like these charities, for example, that in America there was a whole bunch of them that got caught ripping off the American people. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and these were cancer foundations for children's cancer, you know, and sure, women's breast cancer. So here's a charity taking people's money for cancer and then ripping the people off at the same time. You know, and we talk about that a lot. It's having two sets of moral standards, isn't it? It's like you're comfortable with doing this to a human being, but then you go home and sleep at night, and there's far too many people like that in the world walking around, which I just simply don't understand. You know, but I think it's a mental thing as well. And I know you would agree with that. I think the more people we get on board and the more people we get reading this book and talking and starting podcasts like I'm doing and going on social media and linking the more people you attract that are like-minded into your life, I would say there's never been such a change in the history of mankind, in our written history. I think we're standing on the edge here of historic change. There's such a wake-up happening to human beings. And it does worry me a little bit. I always say how desperate these people will become as we get more closer to sort of the head of the snake and exposing them and their system and going our own way and making things more positive and better. They just seem to have another war or they seem to feed on fear. And I think that's what's bringing us down. Yes. All that fear, you know, when human beings are living in fear, it's like when you drown, you know, if you go in the sea and you're drowning and you panic, you're going to die pretty quickly, you know. And I think the human beings are just born and dying in this fear state all the time. And it's being pumped through the media and through our lives and wars and everything. It's just constant, you know. It's really amazing. But I think, as I said, it's a mental thing. And I think, you know, I think you're right there saying that, you know, it's no use sitting back and saying, I know what's going on. I know there's evil people running the planet, but what can I do? Hey, I'm going to go my merry way. I think everybody needs to get on board here and help with this change, because I think it can happen, you know?
Well, it absolutely can. And as I said, it's going to happen through us rendering what they have put in place irrelevant. So we have to disarm them, essentially. And that comes through, it begins with making people aware of what the system actually is. So from the start, when this secret society formed, they knew that the only way they could succeed was through secret political and economic influence and through secret control of educational journalistic and propaganda agencies. This is straight out of their mouths. So it really is an issue of making people realize once and for all that the system itself is something very different than they were led to believe that it is.
Yes.
And through that, the fear, look, with regard to the fear, maybe there needs to be a whole other book that teaches people. I guess different people find solace in different ways with regard to whatever they're going to meet when they finally die, and to each person their own. But the bottom line is, we're all going to die, okay? They absolutely use fear to shut down critical thought. We shouldn't be so afraid. They've taught people and conditioned people like Pavlov's dogs so that they can just push a button, get them to salivate with fear over the most ridiculous things, while at the same time, the people have absolutely no fear of things that they actually should be afraid of, you know, that are a more legitimate threat to them. So maybe that's a whole other topic and a whole other book, but to maybe try to consider that as an alternative delivery vehicle for solutions is to get people mentally in a space where it's like, look, you're going to die. We're all going to die. It's an issue of, how did you live? Did you live and when you are ready to die, or when you do die, do you feel you obeyed your conscience and actually met your own expectations of a human being, or did you fail at that? I think most people, if they thought about that, they'd say, well, yeah, you know what? I am. Of course I'm going to die. I mean, there's a difference between kind of the ethereal hypothetical and, okay, someone's got a gun to my head and I know if I don't do what they say, they're going to kill me. I'm not necessarily talking about that. I'm just talking about in general, to kind of become a little bit more spiritual and a little bit more connected and realize that this life isn't just about being safe. It's about hopefully forwarding whatever evolutionary impulse of the universe is trying to express itself through you. Hopefully that's not too deep, but I don't know. I don't want to get too much into the woo-woo stuff. Maybe that's too much. But for me, I think that's important. I think people need to, as you stated, they need to stop being so afraid, because fear is definitely a lever of power that they wield.
Yeah, that's right. They seem to have a moral code themselves where they, I don't know, they don't do any killing themselves. They get, obviously, young men, you know, to enlist in the militaries and armies and do the killing for them, you know. Seems like, well, the whole world fights each other and slashes and burns and rapes and tortures and kills one another. These people aren't actually getting their hands bloody at all, you know, because they seem to know that you don't kill people in this life, you know.
There's no risk for them.
Yeah, exactly.
If they were to go, you know, if they were going to go do it themselves, they might wind up on the losing end of the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you would agree, hopefully people are starting to wake up, that there's definitely a war on the common man, on the family, you know, on the working class people. I know it's happening in the US and it's happening in Australia, you know, and it's happening in Europe, you know, with this mass immigration into Europe. It's causing chaos there. There seems to be this hatred of the common man, you know, that's able to have a car, for example, and a job and a nice house and a couple of kids and a wife, you know, and able to have a drink on the weekend and this sort of stuff. There seems to be this hateful display against this. And one thing I do notice how they're bringing the common man down is seems to be through, for example, pornography, through sexual energy. It seems to be something that's very powerful that men themselves don't understand, how powerful his sexuality is. You know, and it seems to be that they are attacking man through his sexuality. You know, which is extremely cruel and horrifying when you sort of look at it, you know, and you're getting this attack on the family and the breakdown of the common family, which is going to lead to terrible problems in our society, you know. And you see this definitely through the media and through the pornographic movies and movies and stuff like that, you know. You know, which absolutely astounds me. And reading in your book, just near the start there, it was fascinating how you quickly talked about the takeover of, for example, the media in America, like the biggest papers, you know, like the New York Times and I guess you don't sort of immediately think how powerful this is, do you? You know, when a group like this is able to come in so long ago and take hold of these printed press, which goes out to millions of people. I mean, in Australia, Rupert Murdoch, who's an extremely powerful man, you know, he owns like 70% of our media. You know, most of our big newspapers are from him, and it's all rubbish and propaganda, you know. And it's got so low and so sad and so bad that this printed press, these people who call themselves columnists, are now against the Australian people, stabbing us constantly in the back with utter ruthlessness and viciousness. You just can't believe it. And they're printing this utter rubbish and nonsense. And from what I've seen, it's just got worse. I don't know how it is in the US. And I don't know, as I've said before, if a Trump president would force the media to be better in any way. But it just seems so ugly. But, you know, to come in like that and take over, for example, if you're looking at the United States and you're looking at, you know, big cities like New York City, and you're able to take over the magazines and the printed press and the TV stations and the media that, you know, the television news at 6 o'clock every night. It's such a powerful system, isn't it, to pump out the propaganda, to shape the minds of the people out there that are watching and reading it on the bus every day, you know?
Yes.
It's hard for us. Sometimes it does depress me, Joe, because I think, God, we're doing podcasts and we're doing websites, and you turn on the 6 o'clock news and you read those papers, and they've got so much power, and they're printing so much propaganda and rubbish, and it makes you want to cry, you know? But right. I'm hoping that, you know, I'm seeing a change in Australia anyway, that some of our independent outlets are starting to take over these papers, and I think people are getting sick of it, and they're starting to wake up to this, you know, and I know it's happening in your neck of the woods as well.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's something to be said about a handful of people being able to control 90% of what everybody, you know, the mainstream media puts out.
It's so powerful. Literally,
a handful of people can make everybody in the world aware of something in one day that the day before nobody knew about.
Yeah.
You know, they can reach billions and billions of people. But the other side of that is, again, a lot of people have completely tuned out, and a lot of people no longer pay any attention to it. So we have to remember that. They have realized, because of the internet, which is a two-way communication, this is part of what I was talking about with regard to solutions, making what they have monopolized irrelevant. People, it isn't going to happen overnight. It has almost happened overnight if you think of it on a normal scale of how long it takes for change to sweep through the population. It's just been a relatively short period of time where people have realized, wow, okay, I can get my news from this box that just decides what it's going to tell me, and there's no way for me to interact with it. There's no way for me to get any feedback from anybody else. I'm just going to sit here, and if I want to hear about something, I just hope that they're going to talk to me about it. Or I have this thing called the internet, where literally anything that I'm interested in, I can go search, and not only can I search, I will find one viewpoint, but then there's going to be 100 other viewpoints and 100 other pieces of information that I can use to kind of back up what I'm being told, to find out where the weaknesses are in whatever is being put forward. The latter is so superior to the former that it is absolutely inevitable that the migration away from these newspapers, I mean, the newspapers are not doing well. They're dying. They're nowhere near as prestigious and nowhere near as powerful as they used to be. And the same is true, as far as I'm concerned, for the network news. Most people at this point kind of view the network news the way Russians viewed the propaganda that was pumped out to them during the Cold War. I read a quote once where they said, the only reason you watch the Russian news is to find out what the party line is. It's not that you believe it's true. You just want to know what they want, what they're trying to get you to believe. People eventually wake up to things. So again, I'm optimistic. I feel it's we're in way better shape right now as far as the legitimate and deserved skepticism that people have toward this system compared to what it might have been in, say, 1913. Okay, it's about 100 years later. I would say that we're in a lot better shape than we were then, because people had no idea. That was when they were first really getting their meat hooks into everything, and there was a lot more good faith. And at this point, I think they've pretty much squandered that, and we're definitely moving in the right direction.
That's positive. And can only be positive. How were you able to do this book that you've done, like politically, sort of looking at it politically with what he wrote being so dense and so confusing and so deep? How were you able to sort of take out, I guess what I mean is, in your book, how were you able to write it so you could take all the meat and potatoes of the book, all the sections that you sort of felt important for people like myself to read, and take those sections and put them into your book without sort of losing too much as well? Because that's a pretty neat trick to be able to do that, because it seems like, from what I've heard, it's such a dense book on these societies and how they took hold of the political system, you know, let alone, you know, if you look at what we're just talking about, the media and the banking and the universities and, you know, our education and everything that we've learned. It's like the Truman Show. You know, you're living in a dream world, but that political part of it, I really get lost with that stuff because it's so deep, the way all that runs and how manipulated it is, you know?
It's difficult. It wasn't easy.
You didn't jump out of a window, did you?
It was very, very difficult. I will just say that. It took me a couple years, and it was hard, but it was worth it, you know? It's not... If somebody wants... Everything that's in Tragedy and Hope is there. But for most people who are interested in Tragedy and Hope, the reason they're interested in it is because they've heard this story of this professor named Carol Quigley, who dispelled the myth of representative government and how he laid out precisely how a small group of people can come in to established systems and also create their own additional instruments after gaining control of these established systems, like they did with the United States government, the income tax, and the Federal Reserve System, which he himself says the Federal Reserve System, the central banks, were created to dominate the governments of the nation states. That was their whole purpose. So these are really important pieces of information, and I've framed the book in such a way that I have these assertions. Carol Quigley was this person. Carol Quigley exposed these things, and I pulled out the information that I felt was most compelling to back up those assertions, and then provided footnotes so people who want to dig deeper can. They can go dig deeper into all of these things and make sure that nothing's out of context and everything is exactly as I presented it. My goal is to help people understand what is going on. That is what the purpose of this book is, to introduce people to Carol Quigley in a way that isn't so intimidating, and introduce them to the deceptive, immoral system of government that he exposed. If I can do that, if that's what this book accomplishes, then I'm happy. And I just want to say, you know, for anybody who's listening, you don't have to buy the book. The book is available for free online. So if you go to tragedyandhope.info, you can read the entire thing for free. Of course, if you want to buy it, that's fantastic. It helps. It guarantees that I can, you know, put food on the table and write the next book. But you don't have to. I want there to be no barrier to entry for this information. There is no barrier to entry. You can go to the site, you can read it, and hopefully you'll find the information useful. If you find it useful, tell your friends about it. Leave a review at Amazon. Whatever you feel is appropriate to try to really take this important information that Quigley revealed and get full use out of it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing you've offered it for free. I mean, well, that's incredible. It's great. But as I said before we started, I went on Amazon and got the Kindle for myself. So that's available for folks with Kindle. But they can also get the paperback as well from Amazon. Can they get that from you? Or you just do it through the bookstores and Amazon and stuff?
They can buy through me, but Amazon is really the easiest.
Yeah, $15,
it's the fastest, it's the easiest, so that's fine.
Kindle, it works fine. Yeah, Kindle edition's cheap, and And same thing, so that's good as well. But as you said, you can pick it up for free off your website and have a read. I think that's great what you've done. You know, made it so accessible for everybody. Such a huge book, part of our history.
It makes it easier for people from other countries too, because they can do a cut and paste and translate and stuff like that. I just signed a contract with Kopp Verlag to do a German edition, but I haven't gone through all the other. I'd like to do all the other languages, but it's kind of work. But right now, at least there's another advantage to it. Again, being that people can, you know, if they have another language, they can at least. It's not going to be a great translation, but they'll at least have some idea of what's going on there.
It's such a massive system, isn't it? You know, we talk a lot about the Rockefeller Foundation's involvement in the drug industry, you know, and the start of petroleum drugs and the fluoridization of the water and the vaccines, you know, the sterilization, this sort of decay in Western culture and decay and destruction of Western medicine and traditional medicines as well, and how, you know, that these patented drugs only smother symptoms. They don't cure like natural drugs, like natural medicines, like cannabis does, these types of things. You know, they smother your symptoms, the money they make on tablets and things alone, and, you know.
They make you sicker.
It make people sicker, yeah. There's the whole vaccination issue, which is in your face, you know. You know about the vaxxed film as well, how they don't want people to see it because it clearly shows corruption within the CDC. This is another part of the system that we're talking about today. You know, the CDC, the World Health Organization, they're clearly destroying documents that prove vaccines cause autism and all sorts of childhood, cancers like leukemia and stuff. We're going to find out all that. They're just hiding what they want. But, you know, you're seeing such a reaction here as well to people wanting to know the truth and what's really going on. Because I think this system's gone on way far too long, and they've had so much control as well. You know, I mean, the power grid is amazing, you know.
They've monopolized all these things.
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the schooling system's fascinating to me as well. And the university system and being able to teach what they want. I always say I feel like Truman in the Truman Show. You're just living this sort of dream world that you think's real, but you know, try to sort of go out past the horizon there, and you get zapped. You know, and it's amazing. People are living in this sort of dream world that, you know, a lot of people are comfortable in. But I think it's important for us as humans to try to deconstruct here a little bit and question the so-called reality around us, because boy, this goes way back. I mean, you know, so far back in history, these people, it's amazing to me because it seemed like they had it planned all along. You know, it just seemed like it was so clinical the way they implemented the banking system and the Federal Reserves, and they came in, they took over and monopolized the medical system and our drugs and everything, and right up to our power system, you know, making us pay for power and you know, debt-based banking, of course, and then taking it back through, taking the houses back, and then it seems like every now and then they collapse the economies, take the money in, and then everything gets all right again for a while, everyone forgets about it, and then another collapse, you know. What do you think about these people? Do you think, you know, I read a lot of stories that they have underground bases, places that they can go. Do you think this is true? I know it's probably not anything to do with Quigley's book. I'm just wondering how desperate these networks are going to get as more and more people wake up and start sort of wanting to get answers here, you know, and I'm we sure start getting forced change. I'm wondering if they're going to go underground.
Sure they've probably got contingency plans.
They got the money. Yeah,
nobody ever said they were stupid. They learn. There have always been predators. There have always been rulers.
Predators, yes.
And so the predatory class has always existed, and they're evolving, you know, and they've learned how to do things, and you know, to their credit, they've gotten pretty good at what they're doing up to this point. But they always, periodically, through history, experience disruptions. And I feel like right now we're in one of those periods where they are being disrupted. So let's, as far as I'm concerned, that's our role right now. Our role is to continue that disruption, because it's ridiculous. Of course it's ridiculous. Of course it's utterly ridiculous. And you talk about porn, and it's not just porn. It's materialism. It's soap operas and all of these other things that are put forward. Bertrand Russell, addressed this when he was talking about the Society of Experts. Again, when I talk about these things where you'll have this ruling oligarchy, that it isn't just Quigley who talks about it. There are other very, very well-respected intellectuals who discussed these things. And Bertrand Russell talked about it specifically, that the goal of this group that understands the process of scientific manipulation of the masses, that will rule behind the scenes, will deliberately make the average person foolish and frivolous, so that they feel all that is expected of them is that they go to work during the day, they push the buttons and they pull the levers, and once they've completed that, now it's time to just watch the game, or to get hammered, or pull up to the porn, or what, all of these other things that they use to keep them placated, so that thoughts of discontent do not enter their mind. So let's look at porn, because you brought that up earlier. I haven't researched it a lot. Suffice to say, I agree with you that I don't think it's healthy. And let me give you a perfect example with regard to how porn works on the average 18-year-old male, the average male, period. The average male is at YouTube, and there is a choice, maybe not YouTube. They're online, and they start listening to this podcast, and it contains very important information. And then all of a sudden, on the side, there's a video link where they can, what's that girl's name? Kim Kardashian, having sex with some guy. And they see Kim Kardashian with no clothes. I won't get too graphic, but you understand what I'm saying?
Please don't.
It's going to distract them. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a mass distraction.
Let's see. I can listen to a one-hour podcast, or better yet, I could read a book, or I can do this. They are totally tapping into that, you know, that kind of primal interest. And they continually program people to exaggerate the significance of sex and minimize the significance of relationships and things that are vitally more important, never allowing them to consider the possibility that, yeah, okay, it's sex. I can have sex with somebody I love, who's somebody who's there for me, somebody I have a relationship with. It isn't going to feel any different. But they're just like, they tap into people's egos to get them, you know, to a predator. Cancer is a gold mine. To a predator, to somebody who has no conscience, cancer, oh God, dying children, that's fantastic. Boy, we can use that. Boy, they're going to just fall for that. They're going to throw their money out of their pockets. That's where they are. They understand human psychology and they understand how to manipulate it. So all of this is definitely part of the problem. It's hard to convince somebody who's not yet aware of the fact that pornography might be being used to keep them in a place that prevents them from going deeper into things that are more important, that maybe they should cut back a little bit on that and start paying attention to other things and rewiring themselves a little bit, so it's not such a big deal. And I think you know, there are things that I've read online where people who get really addicted to it, fortunately, they do start to realize that. They start to realize that this is a complete dead end. This isn't fulfilling at all. This is ruining my life. I'm not fulfilled by this. So if that's any consolation, at least there is that side of it, which is pursued to its logical end. People do realize, you know what, this is not healthy, and this is not good for me.
It's it's a real double-edged sword. I just hope enough people can sort of wake up to this and see what's really going on, because it scares me a little bit. I mean, I think people worry about things like Facebook and stuff, and whether it was set up to, you know, take everybody's information. Well, that's fine, but I myself use it to pump out information. I use it as a tool, and I think that's good to use technology as a tool. So I've sort of said, well, okay, I don't really want to go on Facebook. What I can do is make it into a positive and go on there and just pump out information. But I don't put anything personal about myself up there. You know, my pictures of me at home and stuff like that. So you can use technology in a powerful way, which originally I guess they didn't sort of expect us to do, but we're doing. And, looking at Facebook earlier, it was people on there, you know, putting up photos and links of themselves taking a pee, you know, in the morning. Yeah. I'm peeing, and here I am buying a sack of potatoes, and here I am having a coffee, and here I am doing this. Here's my kids, here's my life, here's my house. Here I am in my bedroom. But now you go on there, and it's all like websites and info going out, whether it's medical, whether it's this stuff we're talking about. It's really astonishing, the shift there. One really kind of scary thing for me a bit is the transhumanism side, the kind of merging of the human species with technology. And I know they're trying to do that a lot, but I was watching a breakfast program the other morning, and they were kind of showing the people these goggles. I think they're called like Oculus. Facebook yeah. and companies are about to bring them out. They're sort of goggles, you know them, you wear around your head, and it's like a virtual reality world in there.
Yeah.
And the guy was wearing them, and they showed you what he was seeing, and he was basically under the water, and he was on a sunken ship, and there was like marine life going past his head, and he was actually under the water, you know, in these goggles. And I'm thinking, doing my own research on that, how far they're going to take that, or how far they could take that, is really amazing. Because, you know, that's going to steal people's reality away, where they're, if it's not bad enough gaming all day and playing these terrible games and looking at pornography and movies and not getting out in the sunshine, especially with our children and getting the exercise they need, they're on these games and TVs all day. But this, going into this world with these goggles, is quite frightening for me. And I know they're about to launch a whole lot of them, and I'm wondering if they're going to take off, because they're actually going to get, I saw like an Apple sort of display a while ago where they put this sort of, not an implant, but it was just a sort of a wires on a woman's on a woman's side of her head, and she had a helmet thing on, and she was thinking and writing on the screen, you know. And I'm wondering if they're going to have these sensors that that go into these helmets where you can taste and smell as well. You know, so you'll be able to go and sit in a coffee shop over in Milan, for example, and have a coffee and actually taste it. I know that. And then there'll be companies who actually design the smells and the tastes. And I'm thinking that for pornography alone, when you're able to put on those goggles, you'll be actually able to go into a room and there'll be a real woman standing in front of you who'll do whatever you want. And I'm thinking that's a dangerous thing, because people are going to put that on to escape the real world around them, you know. And I'm worried about that as well, you know. The gaming that people will be able to do in there, and how real it will be.
Don't worry too much. I imagine there are going to be a lot of people who get pulled into it, but then there are going to be people who get pulled into it and then leave it, and there are going to be people who know better. I think technology, there are always going to be things that are there. This is always going to be a fight. We can't force our will on other people. We can't. Well, if you believe in the zero aggression principle, you don't want to.
I agree.
You know, right? So. We just have to do what we can do, and we just have to present our arguments the best we can present our arguments. And again, if somebody gets in a position where, just like an addict, like a drug addict or whatever, they become addicted to virtual reality or whatever, I think the consequences, it will be very unfortunate, but I think the consequences will be apparent to the other people. On the outside, I think they'll say, okay, well, just like you can look at a heroin addict and say, all right, I don't think that looks like a very good idea. I assume that all of these other things can be used. So I'll give you an example. Virtual reality could be pretty cool if it was you and I having a conversation right now. Instead of us just talking and doing the way we're doing through the podcast, if I felt like I was sitting right across from you and you were in Australia and you and I could see my hand gestures and the way I'm moving my
inside
my
the hands. Goggles.
Right. So we've got these, you know, and then I'm looking at you and we're talking, having a conversation. That would be a use of the technology that would be good. People who have goggles on and some kind of apparatus attached to their genitals so they can have a sexual experience might not be, you know, good. It could be, well, I don't, you know, I'm just saying, like, it's going to happen.
Well, they get into the brain waves and the nervous system and everything. They'll be able to give you orgasms through the goggles, you know, and make you taste and smell, yeah.
Sure, I imagine there's all kinds of stuff that they're going to come up with. But right now, that could be, with or without the media, that could be something that people would pursue just from a profit perspective or an interest perspective. But right now, if we can just stay focused on this task in front of us of exposing the fact that this system of government, which hasn't evolved at all, this predatory system of government where you have immoral rulers deceiving and exploiting everybody. We're in the 21st century. Let's try to bring that immoral system down and begin replacing it with decentralized, accountable systems that don't allow these people to do what they do. We're never going to get rid of predators. We're never going to get rid of people who are immoral. But at the very least, we can make it damn hard for them to achieve these types of things that they've managed to achieve.
And it helps, we always say, to not buy into it. And some people think that's silly, but we always say here, you know, boycott the newspapers. You know, it costs you $2 a day, don't buy them. And you know, you get 10 people you know and 10 people they know to stop buying these papers and stop buying into the system in general. You know, take their money out of banks that aren't doing the right thing, buy certain things, do things, live your life a certain way. These companies who are not doing the right thing, they spend billions of dollars trying to get us to buy their products, you know, and they feel it, you know.
Absolutely.
It's really remarkable. Every single person at a consumer level can make a difference. And, you know, there's so many people I meet and hear of that are on the fence. But I guess it's hard for them because they've been working their whole life and they're starting to see this system around them and that something's not right. Whereas a book like Tragedy and Hope can... I think it's really better what you've done, the 101, because I think, you know, you can say, pick up this book, you know, and it's not a huge book. And I think if they can read that, they can see that there's a whole network operating around them that's manufacturing this so-called reality that they see every day and make them see things differently. That goes for people that are on the fence a little bit, that are starting to get a bit disjointed and upset. You know, whether they've lost their house or lost their job and they're starting to see things differently where their whole life they just went along with it. That's a big wake-up call for a lot of people, you know, to get halfway through their life and say, oh, my God, I've been duped, you know. But you don't want those people to be upset because it can be a slog over the head and be too much information too quickly. But what you've done here with this book is take a masterpiece of history teaching and put it into an easy format for people to read, because one thing I noticed straight away with Tragedy and Hope 101, Joseph Plummer, which is you, is that you've made it just for the average person out there in the way that you've written it. So I can see that that's such a hard thing to do. You've taken such dense information and not only put it into a shorter book, but you've written it in a way that immediately grabs the reader and makes it easy. You know, there's no confusing sort of lines where I've got to go back and say, what the hell is he talking about here, you know? I just teared through the first part of the book very quickly and it really resonated with me. So it's really amazing job that you've written for the common person as well. Such dense information. That is not easy to do.
Uh-huh. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I'm noticing. And I'm thinking the whole book's going to be like that. And as I said, I think, It seems, from what I've read, a very dry read, and I think you're going to lose people nowadays, you know? There's so much... People are so used to having technology give them what they want immediately, and they do get frustrated, you know, listening to things that are too long or reading books that are too much. So I think you've done a great job there. So we hope that people can pick it up, and I know a lot of our listeners are already way ahead here, you know? And I probably read both. But for all those people at the fence and people, I think you would agree, Joe, as well, like people out there who already know what we're talking about and are way ahead, it's a good idea for them to get their friends and family and workmates and grandparents and people they know recommend
Absolutely.
These books and get them on, because they may not know. You know, but, you know, I mean, get other people to know and get... You know, that's how I think you help, by sharing information. I think that makes you feel good about yourself as well, because you've offered this book for free. And there could be, you know, thousands of people around the world that are picking up that book and reading it that might not have much money, you know, and they've been able to, you've given them access to something so important, you know.
It makes it a lot more accessible. And, you know, even people who are well-versed in all this, or somebody who's already read Quigley's book, they can find arguments and insights, hopefully, that will, you know, just summarize everything. Because you don't read something like Tragedy and Hope and remember all of it, obviously. So little reminders and little pieces of data, or, you know, instances where I challenge him on certain things that I felt he was blind to because of his proximity to the network. You know, there's, I think there would be value in there for them as well. I think that, you know, it's hopefully going to be useful to anybody who's interested in it, interested in this topic. Hopefully they'll take some value from it.
You've done some other books as well, Leaving the Illusion.
Yeah.
A Journey into the Real World, and also Dishonest Money.
Yeah.
Financing the Road to Ruin. Yeah, Leaving the Illusion looks very interesting. So I'm going to grab that next. That looks
okay. Well, let me tell you this regarding what you said about Tragedy and Hope. I was happy to hear you say that. You know, you're right in it. Just so people know, really, the first few chapters are the most difficult because that's where you're being introduced to all the information. From there forward, I think it flows more easily because clearly I have to introduce you to. You know, if you were new to this, I have to introduce you to people you haven't heard of. I have to introduce you to certain things. So once you get through even those first couple chapters, hopefully the rest will be easier. Leaving the Illusion is a novel. And basically the three books cover three things that I thought were very important. Dishonest Money covers our financial system, which is the Federal Reserve System. Tragedy and Hope 101 covers our fraudulent political system. And Leaving the Illusion, which is a novel, it covers the mindset of the people who control the economic and political system. So it gets into this, the true nature of them. And it's a very different book. It's very different from the other two. The other two are nonfiction, and this is a novel that is written. It's written even more for the average person than the other two. And the other two, like you said, I try to keep everything on a normal layman's level. I don't want to speak like some dry academician, right? I want to just speak normal human beings' language. Leaving the Illusion is even a little bit more of that because it's set in the context of a novel where there's this guy who's living the illusion. So it's hot girls and big money and fast cars and all of this other stuff. And then all of a sudden he's smacked in the face with reality. So if you've read my first two books, you might be like, where is this guy going with this? Because it seems so different. But again, if you make it through the first couple chapters, by the third chapter, you're going to start to see it gets real ugly real fast. And it takes this guy through a journey that's really tough for him. And again, these two can be read for free at the website. So if people go to, if they wanted the free version of Tragedy and Hope 101, they go to tragedyandhope.info. That'll take them to my website. And down the side, they'll see the other books, and they're all available for free too.
I like your website, joeplummer.com. I like the black. Yeah. It looks nice, easy to read, easy to go through. Yep. You've got a newsletter, archives, donate, of course, if anyone wants to help with a few dollars, always helps.
Sure.
And free books. I mean, you can't go wrong there. And of course, people can purchase them. We might wrap it up for today. Is there anything else you wanted to get out there as well?
I think we covered everything. I feel like the most important thing is for people to understand the importance of educating themselves and then, to the extent possible, making other people aware of what they know. I really think that that's where all change throughout history has always started. That's where it has to start there. It has to start with awareness. If everybody is blind and has no idea that anything's wrong, clearly nothing's going to change. So to the extent that we can help people understand that this isn't conspiracy theory. We're not talking about conspiracy theory. We're talking about actual documented reality, about this system being specifically designed to deceive people into believing that they have some semblance of control, when in reality it's controlled by forces that they've never heard of and don't know anything about, and that there's this respected historian that took the time, fortunately, to make them aware of it. That's all something that I think is we can all very much benefit from that, and I think that's the path to beginning to tear down this illegitimate system that they created.
Yeah, it's so powerful just knowing, isn't it? It's amazing. It helps. Yeah, when you start to decode the system, almost when you start to to see it for what it is. It almost all starts, you know, starts to reflect off you, you know, and it starts to sort of crumble around your eyes. It's really strange to explain, but when you start sort of looking at things and seeing the manipulation and what they're trying to do, you realize you're so much smarter than it in so many ways, you know, and you can really start to break it down there. But, you know, as we said, yeah, for people to pick up this book, Tragedy and Hope 101, they can go to your website and, as we said, get it for free and read it. So we'll put this podcast up today and hope we get a lot of people doing that and taking it for themselves, because you've done an incredible job here. So great work, my friend. Very good work. You need a
Thanks
holiday.
Again. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, it's great speaking with you, and I think we mixed it up a bit today and keep people interested. And thanks for coming and chatting with me, and I hope to get you on again sometime soon.
Sounds good. My chatting. Pleasure, man.
Yeah, great to chat with you, and please take care.
You too.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, man.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe Plummer. Really interesting guy. I really very much enjoyed that. And just getting through his book now. So many books. Piles. Well, on my Kindle anyway, and books in the garage. You can never have enough books, but thanks, Joe. That was great. So much knowledge. And I put all these necessary links up today with this. Hope our listeners enjoyed that. Take care. See you again soon.